It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a guest who says that President John F. Kennedy was actually a conservative icon.
But first, we're covering the international talks on Iran's nuclear program, which resumed today in Geneva.
Now, these talks are part of the ongoing effort aimed at curbing Iran's nuclear ambitions.
Hillary Mann Leverett is with us now. She's with American University School of International Service. She's also the co-author of the book Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Hillary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So 2 weeks ago, the international community couldn't agree on terms with Iran. Now those talks are resuming. How close are they to a deal, do you think?
They're closer than they have been for over 10 years, which is when I started working on it at the White House during the Bush administration. We are closer now than we've ever been, and I think in terms of the negotiators, we actually have on both sides the most promising team of negotiators. On the Iranian side, we have both a president and foreign minister who have PhDs from Western universities in international law. The foreign minister has his PhD in international law from the University of Denver. And on the American side, we have Wendy Sherman in particular. She's our Undersecretary of State, and she's a very experienced negotiator. She dealt for years with the Koreans in the Clinton administration, very serious, focused, very, very smart person. I think if there is a deal to be had, and I think there certainly is one within the legal framework of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, this group of negotiators could get it.
Now, in between the time when the talks ended and now, there has been some rhetoric flying. There have been critics who have been using the opportunity to voice their concerns, including Israel and France in the past. They've been outspoken on this, along with some hawks in the United States. What are their concerns?
Well, their concerns very broadly are really the emerging power of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And for the Israelis and the Saudis, who have very similar concerns in this regard, the emerging power of the Islamic Republic of Iran in its nuclear power, its military power, its economic power, its political persuasion throughout the region is a direct challenge to their national security strategies in terms of how they deal with their neighbors in the region. So broadly, that's what's at stake for them. Even for a country like France, an emerging power like Iran or Turkey or China is threatening because France, in a lot of ways, is a power in decline and has very little other justification, really, to claim its Security Council seat at the United Nations other than it's a nuclear power. So for all of these countries that are opposed, there's a certain concern really grounded in competition for power and not so much a concern that someone's going to wipe someone off the map or destroy another country with nuclear weapons.
Well, some of the rhetoric, to talk a little bit more about that has been coming out in the meantime, it's been pretty intense, some of it very pointed. You could call it nasty. And I'm curious if you think whether that rhetoric is going to affect the negotiations going forward.
Well, I think actually, surprisingly in some ways, the most striking change in the rhetoric is from the Iranian side. I had the opportunity to meet with the Iranian leadership in New York when they were here to address the UN General Assembly in September and to go to Tehran. They've made a determination not to allow the type of rhetoric that their previous government under President Ahmadinejad spoke about. They're determined to not let that rhetoric be an excuse for Iran going forward in a variety of areas, including the nuclear area. So we've seen the foreign minister of Iran, the Islamic Republic, actually tweet in Jewish New Year's greetings to the Jewish community of the world, a very striking change in rhetoric. Just last night, the Iranian foreign minister put up his own YouTube video pleading for the international community to give peace a chance, that there really was a different way out other than war and never-ending cycles of war. It's a striking, striking video. So the real change has come. We'll always, of course, remember the strident rhetoric coming out of Iran. But the real change, I think, is coming in terms of the marked positive tone of it at this stage.
And Iran has been, sort of helping itself along in terms of rhetoric in how it views itself. One of the terms that's come out recently in going forward is the term heroic flexibility, and that, this could be the new stance that Iran takes as it moves forward with nuclear talks.
Yes, I mean, it's an interesting phrase. It's actually an older one that the founder of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, said many years ago, and then the new Supreme Leader, relatively new compared to him, Supreme Leader Khamenei, also said several years ago, but they haven't said it for a long time. And I think it does, it is another important indicator of their determination to do whatever is possible from their side to dial down the rhetoric, give a negotiated outcome in diplomacy whatever chance possible. And it's not just because they've become good overnight. It's a real strategy, and the strategy is that if they can show they've done everything they could, they've gone the extra mile in terms of being reasonable and working within an international legal framework, then even if the United States can't go along in the end because of our hardliners or the Israelis or whoever, that the rest of the international community can work more constructively with Iran. And that's what's really important to them as the, you know, kind of ground zero in oil diplomacy and petrodollars and all of the economics and power associated with oil is shifting from the United States east toward China and India. That's where their eye is. So even if they can't get a deal with the United States in Geneva today or tomorrow, their goal is to do whatever they can to be as reasonable as possible and open up the rest of the world.
Now, Iran has insisted that it has the right to enrich uranium and it is building a heavy water reactor. How does the proposed deal, as we know about it, affect those areas?
Those are two of the remaining very important sticking points. I mean, for many analysts, they couldn't even fathom that we would be where we were today 6 months ago. But literally, within the past 6 months, negotiators have been able to really whittle down the concerns that remain to be negotiated to three. One of them is this issue about the right to enrich uranium. The Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which the United States has signed and Iran has signed, Iran signed it as a non-nuclear weapon state, the U.S. as a weapon state. In that treaty, there is a recognition of every state's inalienable right to produce and use nuclear power. This is what Iran has really focused on. It doesn't want to give that up. It doesn't want that to be a decision made by the United States, that if Iran is doing a good thing today or a bad thing tomorrow, it can be taken away. This has been a core concern, and I think if there is no agreement, it will be because the negotiators could not find a way to address Iran's rights in this regard without ceding our position, the U.S. position, that no country really has this right. So that's the main sticking point. The other one that I think is a bit of a sideshow that's been put out there, particularly by the French, is this issue of the heavy water reactor at a place called Arak in Iran. The reason I say this is not really an issue is that this power plant and reactor cannot come online for at least a year. So this agreement that they're working on now is just a first step. It's just to cover 6 months. So easily, lawyers could come up with language that Iran is not going to work on the reactor during the 6 months, is not going to start work, is not going to continue work. They could come up with all sorts of words to massage it. It's not a real issue. I think it's being put out there by people who don't want an agreement.
So in return for concessions, Iran would see a loosening on sanctions. And now the deal on the table is still largely being kept under wraps. But do you have a sense of how important it is for Iran to come out from under these sanctions a bit?
They would very much like to come out from under sanctions. They are a tremendously wealthy country with enormous, enormous hydrocarbon resources. If you count their natural gas and their oil, they have more hydrocarbons than Saudi Arabia does. So we're talking about a huge amount of resources that can be monetized and really increase the standard of living for the population. That said, they have their eye on a long-term goal, which is to get the international community, not necessarily the United States, but get the international community not to be tied to these U.S. Appointed sanctions. Now, if they can do it because the United States is going to lift them, that's great. That's their first choice. They'd like to have a more normal relationship with the United States. But if they have to do it in a way where the U.S. doesn't enforce them as much or doesn't add any new ones, that's also a win for them because what they're looking for is more investment and more trade from China, from Korea, from India. So that's what, you know, that's what they're looking for. They're not pushing for the Obama administration to make huge cuts in the sanctions that the administration can't do anyway.
Now, this is an interim deal that we're looking at right now. It's not the whole thing. But if the six world powers accept this interim deal, what are the bigger fish that they might be after down the road?
Well, for Iran, it is really to come out from under the sanctions, to be able to have its economy fully integrated with the international economy, have its hydrocarbons fully traded and monetized. For them to have a full-fledged commercial nuclear program where they can even sell power plants to Iraq, to Lebanon, to other countries in their neighborhood. So they're very much looking at it in terms of economic and scientific development. For the United States, it's about trying to control, I think, you know, if we take the U.S. position at its word and at its word, they're looking to really curtail the diffusion of nuclear know-how and fuel cycle capabilities in order to stem the risk of proliferation for nuclear weapons. And that, this is where they see Iran as an important case. Now, the reason why I say if we take their word for it, the reason why we should have some skepticism with our own government is that that's not how we treat India. You know, we let India, with a full-scale nuclear weapons program, have an agreement with us for the trade in nuclear technology. We're negotiating right now with Vietnam to have the full fuel cycle capability and reprocessing facilities. So it's something where, you know, I'll take my government's word for it for now, that we're really out to make sure that there's as little proliferation of nuclear weapons as possible, but there are some serious other cases of double standard that we should all take seriously.
All right, and we'll leave it there. Hillary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Hillary Mann Levert with American University School of International Service. She's also the co-author of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Up next, our guest will make the case for viewing President John F. Kennedy as a conservative.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickards.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. With the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy approaching, many are reflecting on the life, legacy, and politics of the 35th president of the United States.
And our next guest says that despite his status as a liberal icon, JFK's political career and accomplishments show the opposite, and he was actually quite the conservative.
Joining us now is Ira Stoll, author of JFK Conservative. Ira, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here again.
So is this hard to pin down, the words conservative, liberal, the policies they're attached to? They change over time. Is it hard to have this argument today over who was a conservative and a liberal 50 years ago?
I agree these definitions are blurry and they do shift over time. But I know a book full of evidence that by the definitions of both his time and ours, Kennedy was a conservative. Eleanor Roosevelt was asked in 1958 by a television reporter, what if the Democrats nominate a conservative like Kennedy and the Republicans nominate a liberal like Rockefeller? She said she hoped it didn't come to that. So Kennedy was labeled as a conservative all through his career.
How did he become a liberal icon, do you reckon?
Well, the argument I make in this book is that some of the more liberal members of his administration wrote these best-selling books that really distort the history to the point of excising sentences out of speeches and changing the chronology of certain speeches to make it look like wishful thinking Kennedy was more liberal than he actually was.
Let's talk about a few of the things you offer up as evidence. You talk a lot about his tax policy. Make the case that we would recognize that then, maybe, and now as more of a conservative approach.
That's right. So the liberal Keynesian economists at the time actually opposed the Kennedy tax cuts. John Kenneth Galbraith wrote to a Keynesian Harvard economics professor who was ambassador to India, wrote to Kennedy, as usual, I would oppose a tax cut. They wanted to increase public spending instead. And then Galbraith actually came to Washington from India to argue against the tax cut. He went back to the White House mess and told his colleagues dejectedly, you know what, you guys, you've won. The president finally told me to shut up about my opposition to the tax cut. Al Gore Sr., the senator from Tennessee, Clinton's vice president's father, described the Kennedy tax cuts at the time as a bonanza for the rich, a bonanza for fat cats is the term he used. And Kennedy went ahead with them anyway, rejecting demands by the AFL-CIO that he restructure them so that more of the benefits went to lower-income people. And Reagan cited those tax cuts as an example later when he was doing his tax cutting. That when liberals say, oh, well, the rates at the time were higher, the Eisenhower-Nixon rate was 91%.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the capital gains rate at the time was 25%. Kennedy wanted to lower it to 19.5%, which is lower than the top capital gains rate is now. Now it's 23.8%.
But wanting to cut something from a 91% marginal rate over a certain amount of money, I mean, a lot of people in the, who would be considered liberals now might not be comfortable with that high a number.
Well, you know, now if you include state and local taxes, the top marginal rates in California and New York City are above 50%, with the government taking more than half of every dollar at the top end that people earn. Kennedy's Treasury Secretary, Douglas Dillon, who was a Wall Street banker and a Republican donor, who Senator Gore actually tried to talk Kennedy out of appointing as Treasury Secretary because he knew he was such a tax cutter, was interviewed immediately soon after Kennedy's death and was asked if this Kennedy tax cut was the end of the tax cutting or if there was room to cut rates even more. And he said he hoped it would be the first of many, especially if the Cold War ended and the government had to spend less money on the military.
So on domestic policy, people look back at John F. Kennedy as the guy who pushed for Medicare at the time. It was called socialized medicine, much like the Clinton health care program, the Affordable Care Act now. That's a big government program. Is that something that conservatives at the time or now would get behind?
Well, Kennedy did give a couple speeches in favor of Medicare. You're right about that. But liberals at the time were disappointed in him for not pushing harder. His priorities were really free trade and the tax cut. And I think it's one of the reasons that Medicare did not get passed during his administration, even though he had Democratic control of both the House and the Senate, is that he did get a free trade bill passed. And that was really his legislative priority, along with the tax cut. And not civil rights legislation either, by the way, which was a lower priority for him than the tax cut.
But still a priority.
Towards the end of his administration, in 1963, Kennedy proposed this big civil rights legislation. And I think Kennedy deserves credit for sending federal marshals in and even troops in to integrate some of the segregated Southern universities. But Martin Luther King at one point described Kennedy's record on civil rights as essentially cautious and defensive. And I think the record is mixed. Kennedy even initially opposed the 1963 March on Washington, where King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech.
Charlie in Milwaukee has called in to, I don't think we'll have time to take his call, but he says, you know, Kennedy's more of a pragmatist. He's making decisions not necessarily on a conservative ideology, but on a case-by-case basis with what works. Is that a more accurate depiction of Kennedy, you think, pragmatist, not conservative?
Well, you know, I hope people buy and read my book. There's really a book's worth of speeches from the very beginning of Kennedy's career. My book begins with a speech he gave as a congressional candidate in 1946, talking about the rights of the individual against the state and Christian morality. He talked about the cynical philosophy of many of our intellectuals and the doctrine of collectivism abroad. And he kept talking like that all through the 1960 campaign. He talked about two conflicting ideologies, freedom under God versus ruthless, godless tyranny. I mean, that's not the language of a pragmatist. That's a language of someone who sees it more clear cut, as he said in another speech, in terms of good versus evil, right versus wrong.
You mentioned Ronald Reagan citing John F. Kennedy's tax cuts. Other than that, have conservatives been willing to embrace JFK as an icon or as an example?
Well, Scott Brown, a Senate candidate in Massachusetts, began his initial successful U.S. Senate campaign as a Republican in Massachusetts with a YouTube ad that morphed Kennedy's face and speech about tax cuts into Brown's own face and Brown's voice speaking the same words. And George W. Bush also, in talking both about tax cuts and enduring in the Iraq War, cited Kennedy in terms of his inaugural address where he said Americans must pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe to assure the survival and success of liberty, or as Kennedy said, liberty.
Ira, thanks so much for joining us again today.
My pleasure.
That's Ira Stoll. His new book is JFK Conservative.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll take a look inside the Rupert Murdoch media empire and how it's affected the current media landscape.
In our Curious Wisconsin segment, we'll learn about a lost city in Wisconsin. It exists, apparently, I'm not familiar with this, in the borders of Madison's Arboretum.
We'll talk to someone who's actually been there. Mm-hmm. And we'll dig into the multi-billion dollar industry that is the trash trade and talk about how it's transforming our economy and our environment.
We'll check in on those stories and the top news stories of the day. That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk with an avian expert about all the birding questions you wanted to ask. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The statewide gun deer season opens this weekend in Wisconsin.
In today's Wisconsin Life, we'll meet Greg Johnson of the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. He's been hunting his whole life. He tries to live as his ancestors did, according to the four seasons. He hunts deer for food and to preserve a traditional way of life.
My name is Biscocquene. I am a hunter from Lac du Flambeau. I hunt for the health of my family, and I hunt for the health of my community. In our ceremonies, we have talks. We let the spirits in the forest know that our intentions are to go out there and harvest the walrus kishi. After the deer presents himself to us and gives us that shot, we ask for forgiveness for taking this life, and we also speak of how it's going to benefit our loved ones and our family through the feasting and the usage of its hide and its weas, its meat. I don't think anybody likes to see a spirit leaving, but then we remember that we're Anishinaabe, and this is what we do, and this is how we live, and we're supposed to do this. We're supposed to be in that circle with that deer and his life. When a person has the ability to hunt, part of that responsibility of hunting is sharing your harvest with the people. We get to hide, and then we get all the different cuts of meat. And everyone else cuts of meat, somebody would like it. That venison, that Wawash Geishi Weas, there's medicine in there. And all the stuff that we don't ingest today, all the natural things, the grasses and all the medicines that grow on earth, Wawash Geishi, he eats that. We eat him, and he gives that to us. So we want to spread that medicine to our community and our elders and give them that original food. Once the hide comes off the deer, the tanning process is begun. The hide can be used for many different applications. Tobacco pouches, moccasins. Those hides are very, very valuable to Ojibwe people and a lot of other native people. Say a baby's going to be born. We make their first moccasins out of that buckskin that we just tanned up. Or a wedding's going to happen. A gift is going to be made out of that to represent that new life with their partner. I work a lot with velvet and buckskin. When velvet was first introduced here in the 1700s, you know, it became a big part of our dress around Ojibwe territory, Anishinaabe territory. That represents a time when our art was at its most fantastic and glorious. That's when every family did it. And today there's only a handful of people left that do that. That role here as Ojibwe people, it's an important role. We're the keepers of the natural world. And so it's our job to maintain this traditional lifestyle for our families and for our reservation, for our elders and for our babies. Without it, we wouldn't know who we are, we wouldn't know where we come from.
That story was produced by Finn Ryan for The Ways. Learn more at theways.org.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can get more information at wisconsinlife.org.
As the weather turns colder, it's a great time to focus on our backyard birding. Mike O'Connor is our guest now. He's a birdwatching expert. He writes a column called Ask the Bird Folks, and his new book is called Why Do Bluebirds Hate Me? Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Veronica, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, your book is organized around questions that you get as the owner of a birdwatching store and as a birdwatching columnist. So let's start with the title of your book. This is something someone asked you. This is someone who just could not manage to see a bluebird. What did you tell him?
Well, you know, I tell them that, you know, it's funny, a few years ago, well, at least in this part, maybe 20 years ago, no one really got to see a bluebird. And now, through efforts of people putting out birdhouses and things, they've come back. And they've come back to such a point that it's almost become a status symbol. People are excited when they get a bluebird either at their feeder or nesting, but there isn't enough to go around. So some people are getting them, some people aren't, and a lot of people take it personally, but in fact, it's really habitat-specific. Bluebirds like a particular area, especially open areas. So if you live in a heavily wooded neighborhood, you're not likely to get them, and some people take it personally, and this guy really thought the bluebirds hated him when I had to tell him, nah, you know, either move or cut down all your trees, and then you'll be fine.
And the birdhouse itself, how much does that have to do with it when it comes to attracting bluebirds?
Well, you can get bluebirds two ways. Here on the we're on Cape Cod, which is on the eastern coast, and the birds in our area push towards the coast in the winter, where it's a touch milder. So we get bluebirds even in the wintertime. So if you have berry bushes or holly bushes in your yard or other kind of berrying trees, you might get them in the wintertime just as visitors. Maybe they'll come to your feeder. They'll come to suet or sunflower without the shells on it and that kind of stuff. But in the summertime, if you have an open yard, then put up a box. A bluebird box is a really simple box, has an inch and a half diameter hole, and you can put those around your yard if you have an open yard, posts preferably. But if you have a tree, you can put it on a tree, but don't put them up very high. They don't like them to be necessarily too high, and I don't think you want to put them up high so you can maintain them. So a simple birdhouse with an inch and a half hole is fine. Doesn't have to be fancy because they're not fancy birds. They just look fancy.
Now, we say the word bluebird. It's not a very fancy name. I used to run across people who thought, you know, a blue jay was a bluebird. But tell us why it's a big deal to see a bluebird.
I'm sorry. What was the second part of that question?
Well, why is it a big deal to see a bluebird? They are cool birds to see.
They are. And like I said, there was a time, and not too long ago when I was growing up, you know, if somebody saw a bluebird, everybody stopped what they were doing and went to see it. It was like a big deal. And now the population has come back, so it's a little bit more commonplace. But I think people gravitate towards, you know, that traditional bluebird of happiness you always hear about. And bluebirds have a little bit sweeter personality. Part of the reason why there weren't many is they're a little bit meeker in terms of birds. So they were driven out by starlings and sparrows would drive them out of the box because they're not very aggressive birds. Blue jays, on the other hand, I kind of like because I got that spunky, feisty personality, and I actually think they're a better-looking bird. But people kind of gravitate to that sweet bluebird look, so that I think they kind of fawn all over those and attracted to those a little bit more.
Yeah, I got to disagree with you. I'm a bluebird person over the blue jay. I guess it's because I know too much about blue jays. They're kind of mean birds, aren't they?
Well, people call them mean, but, you know, if you saw a snowy owl, you'd think that would be beautiful, but that would take the head off your cat in a second.
Really?
You know? Oh, my God. They're unbelievably aggressive birds. They'll eat Canada geese. They'll eat great blue herons. They'll eat just about anything that moves. And so there's nothing sweet about them, but they're attractive. Blue jays do sometimes will raid, you know, other birds' nests. But, you know, I don't know. You know, probably most of your listeners has eaten an egg or two in their past.
All right, so I guess we're not the ones to point the fingers. are about woodpeckers. Now, someone wanted to know, do woodpeckers take baths? And this person thought, you know, I've never seen a woodpecker taking a bath. They must not be very hygienic or something like that. What did you tell them?
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, they absolutely take baths. Just about every bird takes baths. Some birds take dust baths, but they certainly do. You know, probably not as flocky like we mentioned bluebirds a few seconds ago, and they seem to like to take baths together, kind of communal baths. I had a customer who saw a bluebird on her heated bird bath and had never seen a bluebird before, so she went and got her camera and came back, and there were 13 bluebirds all hunkered down in the bird bath splashing around. And a lot of birds take, robins will take communal baths like that. Woodpeckers, not the same way. They kind of independent birds, so they might sneak in when you're not looking and it's not as much of a commotion, but they absolutely take baths. I think I sent her some YouTube clip videos of, you know, people had taken, you know, YouTube's got everything out there, right? So if it's happened, it's been on YouTube right about now. But yeah, they take baths.
What is the most common question you get as a guy who runs a bird watching store?
Oh. Well, the top 10 most commonly asked questions are, how do I keep away squirrels? How do I keep away squirrels? How do I keep away squirrels? Yeah, that's it. You know, you would think that running a birding store at the beginning, I thought, you know, this is going to be a blast. I'll spend all day talking to people about birds and bird feeding. It'll be fun. No, it's just people complaining about
squirrels.
Yeah.
So you're running more of an anti-squirrel store instead of a bird-watching store.
Oh, my goodness. That's all people are those darn squirrels. I even think there's a book by that title now. It's gone, right? But that's it. You know, people want to know how to keep the squirrels away, and we show them different kinds of baffles and that work. You know, there was a time when it was tough to keep away the squirrels, but the squirrel-proof feeders that are out there now have been very effective, and people have been very happy with them. So that's kind of changing. But people always want to know about the seed, and I'm kind of a little bit different than most people. A lot of the people who I got friends that have birding stores, and they all like to sell these special mixes. But I've always been out telling people that a single ingredient is better, because people always ask, what should you feed birds? I say sunflower seeds. Put sunflower seeds in your feeder, and you'll get more birds than you will with anything else. You know, the assortment of seeds seems like a good idea, because we all want variety in our diet, but birds really aren't into that variety.
Well, one bird that will not take a sunflower seed is the hummingbird, and you write about that. Now, you have to use special food to attract a hummer, and someone in your book asked the question also, you know, once you've got that hummingbird, why does a hummingbird hum?
Right. And what's the old joke? Because they don't know the words? Is that what the old joke is?
That's right.
Yeah, it's their wings. Their wings beat so fast, 80 to over 100 times a second. It's a blur. So it actually just makes the noise. And sometimes they'll even turn that humming into an aggression. You know, they can crank up the speed when they're mad at another hummingbird. So they'll use it almost as audio blur by really cranking up the speed of their wings. So I think anybody who's had hummingbird experience, a lot of people, when they go out to fill the feeders, the hummingbirds kind of come to them almost when they get comfortable, and you hear that buzz.
Well, we're talking to Mike O'Connor right now. He's the author of the book, Why Do Bluebirds Hate Me? A Book of Birding Advice.
And we want to hear from you. Is there a question? Maybe you think it's a stupid question. Well, there are no stupid questions. Ask Mike about birds, bird behavior, something that puzzles you. Or do you have a holy grail bird, one that you're always excited to see, or one that you've never seen and you wish you could? Call in and tell us about it. 800-642-1234 is the number. It's 800-642-1234, or you can email talk@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Thanks, Kristen. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our conversation about bird watching with Mike O'Connor. He runs a bird watching store on Cape Cod, and his new book is called Why Do Bluebirds Hate Me? And we're taking your calls right now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And let's go first to David in Lake Geneva. Hi, David.
Yes, hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I have a question. I've got many bird feeders in my backyard, but I do not have a water source close, but within probably 500 yards or so I do have, you know, small ponds and stuff. Is that enough water, close enough, or should I add a bird bath, or what's your suggestion?
All right. Well, thank you, David, for that, and that's it's an interesting one. It kind of jives with a question in your book as well, Mike. Someone who said, how do birds get water if, you know, we're not providing it? What would you tell David?
Yeah, I think that's awesome. If you a pond is great. The trouble is, in your area, I assume it gets cold. I don't know, but I assume you guys get pretty cold.
Just a little.
So when things are frozen, a lot of people have had really good success with these heated bird baths, and they're fairly inexpensive, and they're fairly inexpensive to run. You know, I think we did the math one time, and it came out to be about a quarter a day, so which comes out to less than $30 for an entire season. So when your pond freezes over, David, I would get one of these heated bird baths. You can get separate bird bath heaters, but I like the ones that's a bath with a heater already built in because they're a little bit more efficient, or they're quite a bit more efficient. And then you can put that where you can see it when the birds are coming near your feeders. And it's amazing, you know, because all birds need to drink. Not every bird will come to your bird feeders for the bird seed or suet we offer, but they all need to drink. So I would definitely check out one of those during the wintertime.
All right. Thank you, David. And let's go to Joan in Ferryville. Hi, Joan.
Hi, it's Joanne in Ferryville, and we're right along the Mississippi River, and we have lots of tundra swans that are migrating, and when they're stopping along the Mississippi, they are noisy all the time. They're noisy in the daytime, and they're noisy in the nighttime, and they're noisy when they fly over, and we just wanted to know why they're so noisy.
Okay, some noisy swans. What would you say to that?
Well, you know, unfortunately, here on the East Coast, we don't have tundra swans in Massachusetts, but I would associate them with kind of like the Canada geese. We get plenty of Canada geese in our area, and it's the same thing. They're very communal birds. They like to travel in flocks, and it's kind of just a communication. You know, we hear the flocks of geese going over on a winter's day, and they're yap, 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 yap. Well, other birds, you know, they don't even know it. You can barely hear their wings flap, but they're very quiet, but geese and a lot of waterfowl like to communicate. It's a way of keeping the flock together, basically, what it is. But it's kind of entertaining for us, too. I mean, there's nothing better for me, you know, going for a walk on a winter's night and hear the flocks of geese going overhead. It's kind of a primitive, you know, back-to-nature experience.
Do you have a favorite bird call?
A favorite bird call?
Yeah.
Is that what you asked me?
Yeah.
I'd have to say the loon.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, I think everybody knows what a loon sounds like, and the first time I heard a loon, I used to take kids camping, and I was putting up the tent, and I could hear a loon calling from a distant lake, and I had never heard a loon before, and I just went running, you know, I just went running, there's a loon, you know, and the kids who weren't all at all into bird watching, they go, oh, there's Mike and his crazy birds again, but it's one of those things you don't forget, you know, especially a loon, it's just that haunting. Talk about primitive call. That's the most primitive, I think, of all of them.
Yeah, they do have incredible. And that is something we can hear in Wisconsin. There are a lot of loons on the northern lakes, and sometimes they pass through in Madison as well. And if you're lucky enough to hear them, it's a beautiful thing.
It's quite a treat, yeah.
And let's go to Corliss, who's joining us next in Madison here. Hi, Corliss.
Hi. I have a little story and a question that goes with it. On July 10th, we came home late in the evening and discovered a turkey in our bedroom. It had flown through a double-pane glass window, screen, blinds, brand-new window, and survived. And we were able to capture it, box it. It was, Humane Society said it was the biggest turkey they had ever seen.
Wow.
And we were trying to figure out, you know, we do realize that it probably saw his reflection in the glass. But number one, he's about two blocks out of the area, the range that the turkeys are usually in. And also, he was huge. So he's probably beyond the breeding, dispersing birds, you know, period. And also, we assumed that the males would not be so aggressive defending their territory once you get to mid-July. Any explanation?
All right, Corliss, good question. So, Mike, why would a turkey fly through someone's window?
Well, I think you kind of hit it. I mean, I think that's a... There's two possibilities. One, the bird, we get a lot of birds that fly in and break windows when they're being chased by a predator. That's, a turkey doesn't seem like a bird that's likely to do that, but it's a possibility where it's got startled by a predator and is flying, and sometimes they'll hit a window when they see a dark area, because a lot of times rooms are dark and they think, well, I can go hide there. Doesn't seem like that would be the likely scenario there. I think it's more like what you said, that the birds get incredibly aggressive during the breeding season, which can extend longer than we think. And he sees his reflection, he runs at it. Now, that's extremely common, birds attacking windows. What's unusual is that they actually went through the glass. That's a little bit of a shocker. That doesn't happen all that much. I get calls all the time that people have turkeys. We have a lot of sliding glass doors around here, and turkeys are always whacking at those. But to break through that's a tough one. He's on steroids, apparently, that turkey.
Yeah, I thought turkeys were supposed to be among the smartest birds, and here they are flying through windows like that.
Well, yeah, they all get fooled. You know how it is. During mating time, everybody gets a little crazy.
All right, thanks, Corliss, and hope that's the last time that happens with the turkey in your bedroom.
Yeah, really? Imagine that.
And we'll go next to Sandy in Appleton. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. I love crows. And the only way I've been able to coax them down is with peanut butter bread. But I was wondering if you had any suggestions as to how to get them closer. I've got one that I was working on, and I talked to him, and he talked back, and it kind of that cackly sound.
Yeah.
Like that. But they haven't been, this one particular one hasn't been brave enough to come down when I'm not looking.
All right, so attracting crows is the question, Mike. Any ideas?
You know, yeah, that's good for you, Sandy. I like crows, too. We get a lot of people who aren't really in love with them, but I really get a kick out of them. They're very intelligent birds, very interesting, and they're very wary. You know, here in the wintertime, people will bring us, like, donuts and stuff as snacks, and then when they get stale, we toss them out in the back, and the gulls come down like it's a fumble in football. They jump all over everything. But we throw something out for the crows, and they land, and they think about it, and they get really careful, and they're very slow at coming. I put out a whole corner in my yard for crows. I'm too lazy to make peanut butter bread. So I take whole corn, which is fairly inexpensive, and spread that around. And then, at least in this area, they really seem to like that. They can grab it, swallow it whole really quickly. And again, they're wary, but they come down for that. So I might want to try that, Sandy, put that out there. But yeah, don't expect them to get comfortable, because crows have been persecuted for a long time, so they're not about to warm up unless, I know, you sound like a sweet lady, but they don't necessarily know that.
Okay, well, good luck, I guess, with your crow calling in. And, you know, we talked a little bit, Mike, about the sounds that birds make. We heard about hummingbirds' wings, and there's a bird that you like a lot because it's so good at imitating other birds, the cowbird. Tell us about the cowbird.
Well, cowbirds don't necessarily imitate other birds. They do have a very intricate call, but it's not an imitator. But what cowbirds do is they actually lay their eggs in other birds' nests, kind of like the European cuckoo does. They'll fly in and drop an egg in another bird's nest, and we get a lot of calls where you'll see like a little song sparrow feeding a bird that's three times its size. And so it looks like the baby bird is feeding the adult, where actually the big bird is the baby, and the parent, the smaller songbird, raised this larger bird. And so they call them parasitic, where the cowbird historically would follow the buffalo herds, and they'd follow them because as the buffaloes went through the prairies, they kick up all these insects, and the birds would eat them. So they could never stay in one spot long enough to lay their eggs in their own nests. So they just drop in other birds and let the other birds raise their kids for them.
You know what? I was thinking about the catbird, but it's good to hear about the cowbird too. And Mike, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on, Veronica. I appreciate that.
We've been talking to Mike O'Connor. He is the author of Why Do Bluebirds Hate Me?
Coming up, why some state lawmakers say Wisconsin needs a shorter shelf life on collected license plate surveillance photos.
Got a comment on what you've heard on our show? You can share your thoughts on our Facebook page. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.